This is Warrior Kid Podcast number 30, Ask Uncle Jake. And this podcast is based on the three Way of the Warrior Kid books. The first one, Wimpy to Warrior, the Navy SEAL Way. The second one, Mark's Mission. And now, a third one, which is called Where There's a Will. And the books are about young Mark, who faces a lot of the problems that kids everywhere face. But Mark gets help solving those problems from his Uncle Jake, who was a Navy SEAL and who stays with Mark in the summertime. Now, this podcast is usually for kids to hear some more lessons from Uncle Jake and also get the chance to ask Uncle Jake some questions. But today, we have a guest on the podcast by the name of Solomon Schmidt. Now, Solomon Schmidt is still a kid, but he's an author. He's 16 years old. He's already written 5 books, and all of the books are history books. He also plays piano and is a member of the Civil Air Patrol. Pretty good track he's got going right now. Solomon, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It's very good to meet you.
You too.
So all of the books that you've written are history books. What made you start to get interested in history?
Well, my mom has been reading to me from the time I was really young. For as long as I can remember, she was putting books in my hands, and she's the one who taught me how to read and write. And I guess there never really was a time when I wasn't interested in history. I can remember a specific children's book. It was an overview of the Statue of Liberty and how it was built, how it was brought to America. It was a little picture book for 8 and 9 year olds, but that's the first American history book I can clearly remember. And I remember from that, I was really interested in the Titanic for the longest time, so I read a lot of books on that. I watched the old, I think, 1950s, 60s version of it, and like I said, I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in history, and it spiraled into getting interested in specific topics like World War II, which I was on for the longest time, Winston Churchill, all the battles and generals, and the Civil War, American Revolution. Usually military history is what fascinates me the most, but yeah, I can't remember a time when I haven't been learning about it and intrigued to learn more and read more and study more.
Now, if I've heard correctly, is there some connection to your family and the military, and specifically Pearl Harbor?
Oh, yeah. My great-grandpa, who turned 98 just a couple weeks ago, he was actually at Pearl Harbor the day it was attacked. He's one of only a few survivors left. He was kind of removed from the main area of attack. He was getting his ammunition inspected, and an officer ran into the tent, and he said, "Grab your guns, we're at war." And he said by the time everything was pulled out and gotten ready for the attack to fight against the Japanese planes, the first wave was gone. And he told me that he didn't have a big part in actually fighting against the Japanese, but it's always something that has stayed with him, and he still has memories of being there and of fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. He drove trucks around. That was his job. I'm not sure if he was ever actually in like battles where he shot people, but he served in the war for 4 years, and I really think that's something that I can look back on, and that's a tie to history right there in my own family. You know, one of the few people that's actually a survivor of Pearl Harbor is my great-grandpa, my mom's grandpa, and he's just a great guy. He still plays his harmonica at nursing homes, even though he's almost a century old. But I love people who have continued to keep the legacy alive by teaching people about history, by caring about our country, and knowing that patriotism and a love of country, especially when you're serving in the military, is so important. And he did have that, and he loves America. And Pearl Harbor, I think, is something that has always stayed with him. He's usually pretty quiet when I talk about his military service or when I want to ask him about that. But Pearl Harbor is something he opened up to me more, I think, because it's something that, like I said, he wasn't like in the main part of the attack, but he was definitely impacted by it.
Yeah, well, the military is a giant organization, and the amount of people that are actually on the front lines fighting is usually very, very small, much smaller than what people think. But in order to get those troops on the front lines to actually be able to fight, there is a massive amount of logistics, What does logistics means? It means the people need food, the people need fuel, the people need ammunition for their weapons, they need medical supplies. There's all these things that the soldiers that are on the front lines need. And so your great-grandfather, you said?
Great-grandfather,
so your great-grandfather.
Yeah. Wilford Adderman is his name.
And he played the role that he played for in serving his country was to deliver those logistics to the front lines. And even though he might not feel or you might think, oh, he wasn't fighting on the front lines, trust me, as a guy that was on the front lines, if you don't have those back logistics behind you to support you, you're not going to be able to make anything happen. Mm-hmm. So that's why whenever somebody tells me that they served, no matter what capacity that they served in the military, I always thank them for their service because they were doing what their country needed them to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you transitioned at some point from reading about history into writing about history. How old were you when you wrote your first book?
I started writing it when I was 12, and I had been struggling for a little while to kind of wonder, you know, what should I do? What should my thing be? I started by making a board game called Politic Power. It was a little makeshift board game
I put
together.
How old were you when you made the book, the board game Politic Power?
I started that, I think, when I was 11.
That's interesting.
And I started putting it together.
Just so you know, when I was 11, my friends and I were throwing mud at each other. I think you were already progressed a little bit further than me. Okay, so you make the board game Politic Power?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was kind of like Monopoly. Mm-hmm. It had a board exactly like it, a go position, and, you know, you get sent to jail if you commit an illegal act in politics. But anyway, it had all these pieces, and I'd gotten everything, but, of course, then it comes down to actually, okay, but how do you finish it and actually make it a board game? So I was struggling to know how to do that, and I came down to the basement one day to my dad's workbench, and we started talking, and he said, you know, Solomon, what do you really love? And I said, well, history, Dad. And he said, well, why don't you write a history book for kids your age? And at the time, I think I was 11 when that happened, and I was intrigued by the idea, and we know this man who's written over 100 books, and he gave me a piece of advice. He said, well, actually, he told my dad, he said, never do a project if somebody else has already done it and done it very well, because then you're just wasting your time. So my dad told me, okay, well, I'm glad for you, you should do this, but be sure there isn't anything already out there like it. So I did my research, I looked around, and I couldn't find anything in the format or for the audience I was targeting about U.S. history, and I knew that's what I wanted to do, and I finished it. I worked on it for several months, finishing the sections, and I can remember one time we were on vacation in the Adirondack Mountains in New York. I remember that's where I wrote the Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't know why I remember that, but certain things stay in my memory from all different points of writing the books. But yeah, that's how U.S. History Bites came to be.
Now, you kind of breezed over the fact that in a few months you finished the book. Now, as you know, I've written a bunch of books as well, and it's not easy to write a book. And I always tell people the books don't write themselves. You actually have to do the work. What was there any particular thing that you did to ensure that you got your project done?
Well, I can remember I don't specifically remember with U.S. History Bites. I remember that my goal was, because at the time, I didn't think I was going to be writing any other ones. So my goal was just, okay, I just want to write this book, so I didn't have a specific time. I think, now of course the research process is a completely different process and takes by itself. I think I left myself 6 months to actually write the 30 sections. And I can remember clearly with my last books though, with my most recent books, I would figure out what day of what month I needed to be done by, and I'd figure out how many sections I would need to do in order to achieve that goal and how I would need to break it up, and I'd get it done. And it really just came to a matter of each day I'd go, okay, whether I have a headache or not, whether I feel like it or not, I have to get this section done today. I have to get this part of research done today. I have to read about Gandhi today. And that's what I need to do. And kind of like you talk about in your books, I went to bed feeling great. And I woke up the next morning feeling ready to go on to whatever was next.
Yeah. One of the things that I talk about when it comes to my writing process is I write 1,000 words a day. When I'm writing a book, I write 1,000 words every single day. It takes me about 45 minutes to an hour to get that done. And what it does, there's a couple big benefits to it. Well, number one, you're slowly chipping away at this big giant project. And if you woke up today and you said, I'm going to write 100,000 words today, that would be very intimidating. Mm-hmm. And I don't recommend doing that. But if you wake up and you say, look, I'm going to find 45 minutes today, I'm going to find an hour, and I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do, which is hammer out these 1,000 words. What's good about it, that's good. You get it done little bits at a time, which is, it's easier. You ever heard that expression about eating an elephant? How do you eat an elephant?
One limb at a time?
Well, one bite at a time, One bite at a time. That's all you can do. You can't eat that. You can't stuff that whole elephant in your mouth. Not that I advise eating elephants. But if you were to have to eat an elephant, you'd want to do a little bit at a time. So the good thing is that you're taking little bites of your project. The other thing that's good about writing every day, in my opinion, is if I skip 3 days of writing, when I open my computer back up to start writing again, I forgot what the last thing I wrote was. Now I have to go mm-hmm. back and spend 20 minutes or 30 minutes or maybe even 45 minutes to an hour rereading what I wrote to get myself back up to where I can start writing again. I have to redeploy my brain. And that redeployment time takes time. Mm-hmm. So that's why I always recommend you take that and you do it every single day. And what's good, and the reason I'm spending a little bit of time talking about this, is that this applies to really anything that you want to get good at. Whether it's you want to get good at, I play guitar, I know you play piano, you don't want to try and save up for a month worth of practice at piano and say, well, what I'm going to do is just one weekend I'm going to practice 89 hours.
Yep.
I don't even know if that's mathematically possible. But you don't want to do that. It's much, much better, and it's better for your skill to practice that instrument every single day. If it's a sport you want to get good at, if you want to get good at dribbling a basketball, don't just say, okay, well, 1 week before basketball season, I'm just going to dribble the basketball a lot for 18 hours a day. That's not how you get good at it. You get good at it by doing little bits at a time, but you do it really consistently every single day. That's how you get good. How good are you at piano?
I'd probably put myself at mid-intermediate, maybe.
And how often do you practice?
Every day, Monday to Friday, okay. And then Saturday, just kind of, if I need a break during the day, or I know I have something I want to play or want to get done, I might sit down and play for a little while, but piano's one of those things where I finish my practicing time, and then any other time I play during the day is just me wanting to sit down and play it, because sometimes, you know, and I know this helps some people with music as almost a de-stressor. Mm-hmm. They use it kind of to, sometimes when I am having a lot and I need to just start thinking clearly about something, I go up and play a piano piece and just think through what I need to do and then go back downstairs and keep working. So throughout the day, I'll come back and play it.
Yeah, and that's the same thing. I play the guitar, and it definitely is one of the most relaxing things I do, even though it's hard, but just playing it definitely is it's a good way to relax. The last thing I'll say about this, and that you mentioned, was you in your head, and maybe even perhaps on paper, you wrote down, hey, here's my goal, here's where I want to achieve it by. And then from that, you worked backwards to figure out the steps you need to take. Same thing, you can actually take that technique and apply it to just about anything that you want to get done, any kind of a project, any skill you want to get. You want to make the basketball team? Here's what you got to do to give yourself the best chance for making the basketball team. You want to be able to play a certain piano piece? Okay, this is how many hours of practice it's going to take. Here's how I'm going to set it up. I want to learn this guitar solo? Here's what it's going to take for me to get there, and I'm going to chip away at it every day. Those are great techniques to use to kind of tackle any project that you might have out there.
Right.
Now, something else that you're on the path of is you're a member of the Civil Air Patrol. Tell us a little bit about the Civil Air Patrol for folks that don't have any idea what it is.
So Civil Air Patrol is an auxiliary of the Air Force. We're not actually members of the military, although sometimes I've known cadets who have walked into, you know, like McDonald's, and they'll get a free pop because people say thank you for your service. But so Civil Air Patrol, we meet once a week on Friday nights, and we get together and we learn leadership, we learn drill, aerospace, emergency services, we do classes, we do PT once a month, and we get together and we teach classes, and there are different ranks you can promote. You start as a cadet basic, and you can promote in the program all the way up to cadet colonel, which takes years to do and a lot of work. You can promote I think it's every 56 days. And, you know, there are like 8 requirements you have to have. You have to pass an aerospace test, leadership test, fitness test, and a few other things. But I go once a night on, once a week on Friday night to Niagara. I live near Niagara Falls, so I go to Niagara Composite Squadron. We meet from 7 to 10, and I have the position in my squadron of training NCOIC. So my job is, I have 3 training officers under me. My job is to approve classes for the schedule and send them to be scheduled. So if classes are done, they go through me, I look over them, and then send them to the person who takes care of actually getting a date for them and a time. Then I report back and have my officers try and figure out who's interested in doing a class, what program can we develop. And actually, we're going to be starting a program on your book, Extreme Ownership, very soon, so that's coming up.
Nice, nice. How does the Civil Air Patrol actually get employed?
So it's a volunteer organization. It usually comes through people telling their friends, people going to school and saying, hey, you should come and visit. You visit for 3 weeks, and then you can actually sign paperwork and become a member of the squadron. And but yeah, it's a volunteer organization, and sometimes people who want to crack down hard on the cadets have to be reminded that, hey, you know, this isn't the military. People aren't paid to be here. They can leave if they don't like to be here, if you're not making it more of a, I guess, a welcoming environment. Mm-hmm. So,
but the function that they can actually serve, because sometimes the Civil Air Patrol gets called to perform functions to help out in certain situations. Can you give an example of what situations the Civil Air Patrol might get called out to assist in?
I know they were called out after 9/11. They were called to come and assist, but they also do other missions. Like if there's an aircraft down, they've been sent up to find the people who were lost, unfortunately. Sometimes they're sent for border patrol in airplanes. And besides that, you know, a lot of the inner workings of CAP isn't my area of expertise, but I know through people telling stories, and there's plaques about my squadron of stories of cadets who have gone out and become heroes through the missions they've accomplished.
Now, are you looking at this current kind of, I don't want to call it a hobby, but it's an interest right now of being in the Civil Air Patrol. Are you thinking that this might lead to some kind of a future for you inside the military?
Right now, for the longest time, I wanted to be an officer in the Air Force. I'm not sure if the military is something I want to go into, but the great thing about CAP, as we call it, is it prepares you for life by teaching you leadership principles like you have in all your books that don't just apply to people who are in the military, even though those are some of the best situations to use them in. The things you learn in CAP and being over people and interacting with people and what works and what doesn't in leadership, actually getting to apply that in real life each week is such a benefit. And people have stories where they went on to business and other things, and they could remember lessons they learned from CAP. And of course, there are a lot of people we have that go right into the Air Force. We have 2 cadets who are leaving soon to go into the Army and I think the Navy.
Okay.
So yeah, some people do use it as a stepping stone to go into the military.
Now, if you're 16 years old, so you'll finish your high school, are you going to try and go to college? What do you think your post high school education is going to look like?
So right now I'm looking into going into a program with State University of New York, looking to go for my bachelor's degree in history through them.
I guess that's not a big surprise, right? For you to go try and major in history.
And then from there, I'm looking at a few colleges right now. Not sure what, because it's so far down the road still to get actually a master's and PhD in history.
And then what do you want to do with that master's in history and even a PhD in history, which is how many years of school? For the kids out there that hear that, what does that mean, PhD in history?
It's about 7 years of work in college, and then it ends with a dissertation, which could be as long as, I've heard of some dissertations that are 900 pages long, where you have to write a research project basically on a subject that's related to what you've been studying, and then that's your final assignment.
And what would you want to do with that PhD in history besides know a bunch of stuff?
Well, I think I want to teach at the college level and be a professor and help the next generation learn history, because it's another great way to teach it, not just through books. But the nice thing about, of course, you know, being a college professor is they're encouraged to keep writing, and that's something I want to do. I always want to keep writing on the side for sure. I don't think it's something I want to make my career, like just being an author. But it's definitely something I want to keep up because I think the topics I write about are important for kids at a very young age to learn because, I mean, I don't think you can learn history too young. It's one of those subjects where it's so important because you're always going to be needing that knowledge throughout your whole life. And there's always more to learn about history. That's what always amazes me. I've met historians who have been studying history for 50, 60 years, and they still have so much that they don't know, even though they own 7,000 books. And they can tell me about so many different places. And there's still areas that, you know, they either don't know a lot about or they still have things to learn, books to read, because there's so many books.
You know, one of the things that I love about history, and I think that our education system can miss this, which means I think our school system can miss this a little bit, is that when you look at history, you see, if you look hard enough, and sometimes you don't even have to look that hard, everything that we learn is connected. Everything that we learn. When you learn a poem in English, well, guess what? That poem was written by someone who was living through a certain time period, who experienced certain things in that time period. When you learn a scientific fact, well, there's somebody that learned or discovered that scientific fact, who is in a certain time period of the world, who experienced certain things in that time period, who lived in a certain culture during a certain time. No matter what you learn, if you learn to play piano, well, there's someone that created the first mm-hmm. piano and someone that put together notes and someone that figured out how to organize those notes into a song. And all those things can be traced through history. So no matter what you're learning, no matter what subject you're learning, every subject can be tied together through the same thread of history. And that's why I think history is a great basis to learn from, because I think, and I know it's totally true for me, I learn better when I see the connections between different things. And I've found that when I taught my own kids, it was much easier to teach them when I could tie what they were learning to other things mm-hmm. that they had learned. And that's why I think history is a great thing that ties really everything together that we learn.
Yeah, it's true. And then I've heard people say that it's the most important subject. And I mean, practically, of course, math is so important, knowing basic math. But I think history, I think there is something to that argument of history being the most important. And what you said makes a lot of sense.
How often do you read?
Well, a lot of my reading comes for researching for my books. I have some pastime books I read, but I try to keep a good amount. I try to keep a certain amount of the day apportioned to reading so that I keep getting done what I need to, because otherwise it just, if I put it off and say I'm going to do it later in the day, a lot of times it gets to dinner and it's not done. So
I was an English major in college, and there was one semester where I made a really bad decision. And that decision was to take 5 English classes at one time. I know college is a long way away for a lot of kids that are listening to this, but I recommend you do not take 5 English classes at one time. And here's why. I got assigned, you know, we had to read books. When you're studying mm-hmm. English, you have to read books. I had to read so many books that I would spend 8, 10, or 12 hours on Saturday and Sunday for an entire semester, which is 4 months long, of just reading. And it actually hurt my eyes. My eyes would hurt. So try not to have to read that much. But one of the things that I also say about reading is the at the top of the pyramid in terms of how to become smarter. Mm-hmm. Right? How to become smarter. The best way to become smarter is to read.
Right.
And the best way to become, then the next best thing is to start writing.
Yep.
And so you're doing both those things right now. So we hope you're getting pretty smart at this point, Solomon.
I know there's a lot of people that know a lot more than I do.
Well, that's a good humble attitude to have, and there's certainly always more to learn. But speaking of your books, I've got one of your books right here. This book is called U.S. Presidential History Bites, and it talks about the presidents of the United States of America. And of course, because it talks about the presidents of the United States of America, it starts with the first president of the United States of America, who's I think my favorite president, a guy by the name of George Washington. I'm going to read a real quick little section that you wrote. George Washington was born in Westmoreland County, Virginia in 1732. His parents were Augustine and Mary Washington. George had seven siblings, two older brothers and five younger brothers and sisters. When his older brother Lawrence joined the English Navy, George wanted to join too. However, his mother would not let him because he was only 11 years old. George grew up and became a surveyor. A surveyor is someone that goes out and surveys the land and figures out where property lines are. And you continue on here. As a surveyor, he took many exciting journeys, including one in which he was almost captured by Native Americans. During this time, the English and the French, so this is before America even existed. During this time, the English and French controlled land in America. Each country wanted to take land from the other so they could have more power. This started a war in 1756 called the French and Indian War. George fought for the English, who eventually won. That might come as a surprise to some people that he was actually fighting for the British, the English. And he continues on here in another section. After the French and Indian War, England made the American colonists pay a lot of money in taxes. The English did this because they had spent almost all of their money during the war and were hoping to gain some of it back by overtaxing the colonists. And the colonists were the people that had come to America and were living here. This made the colonists angry, and they wanted America to become an independent country separate from England. This led to a war between the colonists and the English called the American Revolution, also known as the War for Independence or the Revolutionary War. The colonists chose George Washington to lead the American Continental Army, and he was a brave general during the war. Eventually, America won and became its own country. After the war, Mr. Washington helped to form America's new government. He was very popular with many Americans, and in 1788, he was elected as the first United States president. And he was inaugurated in New York City, which was the capital of America at that time. So there's just a little introduction. That's the first president, President Washington, and that's the first section of this book, U.S. Presidential History, in History Bites. And you call it History Bites because there's little sections of history in these that you break down in nice, simple format. So kids, what age groups would you say these books are written for?
Well, the primary audience is elementary to early middle school, but they're really for anyone of all ages that wants to learn history. I've had adults tell me that they enjoy them, grandparents. But yeah, target audience is probably ages 5 to 10.
Awesome. And they're also good. I know that they can be read. I know I've read this one in particular to my daughter. So it's a good book to read to kids. And I think that's great. I think that's a great introduction to George Washington. Like I said, I think it's a good introduction to your books. And if people want to get your books or they want to hear from you, what's the best way to do that?
My website is historybites.com. You can order the books there. There's also a way to contact me on the website.
And then don't you have a YouTube channel?
I do, yeah. It's just called History Bites. I have videos uploaded that go along with U.S. History Bites and U.S. Presidential History Bites. But lately, I've been doing a lot more videos with green screen and special effects on different famous people from world history. And I've also got some interviews coming up, too.
What kind of special effects are you putting on this green screen? Are we talking lasers? Talking explosions? What are we talking about?
Well, what's really nice about the green screen is I can be anywhere I'm talking about. If I want to be on top of Mount Everest, I can be on top of Mount Everest. If I'm talking about Mother Teresa, I can have Mother Teresa right behind me on the screen. And I think it's a great way to catch people's attention, to keep them watching the video, and it's another way to learn history.
Awesome. All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for this Warrior Kid podcast. And if you want to get one of the Warrior Kid books, you can get all the Warrior Kid books at warriorkid.com. Once again, if you want to get the History Bites books, you can get those at historybites.com. You can also get them on Amazon, right?
Yes.
And you can also get a book called Mikey and the Dragons from Amazon. And if you want a Warrior Kid t-shirt or Jiu-Jitsu rash guard, you can get them from jockostore.com. And if you are training Jiu-Jitsu and you need a Jiu-Jitsu gi, you can get one of those for kids at originmaine.com. You can also get something called Warrior Kid Mulk, which is a drink that makes you stronger and healthier. It's got protein in it, and it tastes delicious. And also, if you want a Warrior Kid picture for your wall, you can get that from flipsidecanvas.com. And that's it. So thanks to Solomon for coming on. I appreciate it. Thanks
Thank you.
For reading the books. And remember what Solomon has learned, and that is that you can learn a lot from history. And you can also accomplish a lot by setting goals and then working every day towards those goals, even if you're a kid. Now go out there and train hard, study hard, work hard, get after it, and be a warrior kid.